great to have Neil Froneman, who is the CEO of Sibanye Stillwater. Neil, I suppose a period of South African history is coming to an end with your stepping down from the position of CEO on the 30th of September. How are you feeling at this juncture?
Hi, Bronwyn, and nice to chat. Let me just say that first. I suppose it's something I've looked forward to. The closer I get to D-Day, I do have FOMO, you know, that fear of missing out on the next chapter. But you know, I've carefully considered this over a long period of time. I've worked hard. It's a new chapter, and I'm really looking forward to it. So every now and then I get that cringe. Oh dear, what is going to happen, you know, on the first? But no, I'm fine. I'm good, and emotionally ready for retirement. And that doesn't mean stop working. It means a new chapter.
What, in terms of the new chapter, what are you most excited about? I want to go there before we look back at your time at Sibanye Stillwater.
So I have a lot of interests. I'm a person that likes to do things well. And my interests include things like flying, extra long distance shooting, music. I used to be able to play the keyboards. I taught myself to play the drums. You know, that takes practice every day. Over the last 10 years, I haven't had time. I enjoy boating, fishing, a bit of hunting. Of course, I haven't spent a lot of time with my family, and that is something I want to do. I want to do a few entrepreneurial things as well. You know, I have a view that one of my better attributes is seeing value where many people don't see value. I've been asked to lead a consortium on bringing Formula One and MotoGP back to South Africa. That's completely off the wall. In my earlier days, I did used to do a bit of motor racing. I, in fact, raced again when I was in my 40s. And of course, that interest, plus, of course, this being in the national interest is something that I'm going to do. And then, you know, a few small things perhaps in mining. But certainly not, I don't want to run a big company again. It's like being on a treadmill, being measured every quarter. Which doesn't make sense in mining. It's a new chapter, doing new things at my own rate, own time, and so on.
So thank you for the insights into you personally. I think the audience is really going to appreciate getting to know Neil Froneman a little more than the corporate titan that we all used to. You talk about measurement and the pressure of being on a treadmill, but the measurement since 2013 has really been of value creation, and that is your ultimate legacy. You've created enormous value for shareholders, Neil. Are you satisfied with that as your legacy?
I think it's a good legacy. I'd like to think that even before Sibanye, there was a lot of value creation, both in Gold One, in Uranium One, of course. There's always challenges in terms of what you do, but value creation is a very important part of running a business. And I suppose I broaden it into value creation not just for shareholders, which is very measurable, but value creation for all stakeholders. But very pleased with what we've achieved. I'm certain we could have done better, but we did well.
When you look at some of the milestones, the critical milestones, and here you look at your initiative to diversify straight away from gold, And now that you've achieved diversity from a geographic perspective and diversity from an offering perspective, ultimately, do you see that there's further room to diversify, or do you think this is a fair compete?
No, I think we are only, let's say, we've only partially implemented our diversification strategy at Sibanye. The opportunity to, let's say, build a portfolio that is more geographically diversified is important. It's important to broaden the portfolio into the battery metals. We really only were able to complete one or two steps. There's many more to go. So there's an entire canvas which is available to be painted on by Richard Stewart, which I'm sure he will do in his own way.
If you were to describe to a layperson what has transpired over the last more than 12 years, when you started 2013, I mean, that's when Sibanye Stillwater was founded. How would you describe the organization in terms of where you've come from to where you are today?
Yeah, and probably the best way is to almost just recap at a high level as to what we did, what the strategy was, and where we are today. So we were very privileged, I must say, to be given the opportunity as a new management team to take Gold Fields' legacy assets and really high-quality names, Driefontein, Kloof, and Beatrix, and set them up as industry-leading dividend payers. And that was the very first part of the strategy, was to position Sibanye as a leading dividend payer in the precious metal sector, which we did. And you might say, well, why is that important? That's just a natural part of business. Well, first of all, the gold companies weren't doing it, and they were on very low dividend yields. We ended up 4.5%, whereas they were on dividend yields of 0.5%, 1%. You know, so that was 400 times or 400% more than what they were paying. But why that was important is because it built a shareholder base that was based on dividend yield and earnings. And they weren't too concerned whether it came from gold or PGMs. And of course, that allowed us to move into our first step of diversification. And we were able to, in four steps, go from zero exposure to one of the biggest PGM exposures, predominantly in South Africa. And we used our, let's say, our experience in the gold sector, where consolidation became a way of surviving. We used consolidation in a low period of PGM commodity prices to reduce the risk and get the costs down, and therefore not bet the farm on making these entries. And of course, PGMs together with gold creates this, let's say, portfolio of precious metal assets. But at that time, and remember, we completed our entry into PGMs, by 2019. The world had begun to change. Global warming was a real issue, and carbon reduction, and therefore renewable energy, was a key focus. And of course, the role that metals play in that became the single biggest constraint in the world decarbonizing. Gold is not a green metal. It's an insurance policy. But PGMs are green metal. Today they predominantly used in the reduction of CO2 and other noxious gases from internal combustion engines, but they do play a role in the future hydrogen economy. And when you start combining PGMs with the battery metals, you can really start talking about green metals. And there is no mining company that is a combination of those two concepts, being green metals, being PGMs, and battery metals. So it made us unique in the sector, which became the third part of the strategy. But of course, as we implemented that strategy, COVID hit us. The world went through a lot of disruption. Battery metals became flavor of the month. The market got very frothy. And listen, a strategy and the implementation of it, if it's not creating value, then it's just academic. And we weren't going to implement the strategy just to implement a strategy. So it became very difficult to find value accretive opportunities during that period. And in fact, it's only today where you start seeing, because of depressed, let's say more realistic views on battery metals, you start seeing opportunities in the market again. But unfortunately, we've also been through a low in PGM commodity prices. So our balance sheet is not as strong as it was or should be to make some of the further moves. But of course, there's been a recovery now in PGM prices, and I have no doubt the company will, in my absence, continue to build its portfolio of green metals or battery metals to complement the PGMs. So that's really been the story of Sibanye at a high level.
When you look at that measurement from the market, and particularly from your buy side, sell side analysts, I remember one CEO saying to me early on in my broadcast career that it's much easier to run a business on paper than it is in reality. How do you respond to those critics who often have the answers on paper?
You know, my team gets very unhappy with those type of people that run it on paper. And I really take a view that, listen, let's be sensitive to their job. We're a complicated company. A lot of it is in the strategy, but we are here to create value. And our track record speaks for itself. So that is probably, to me, the only disappointing part is I know they can't, let's say, analyze things that don't exist. But surely, you know, if management has a track record and has delivered very significant value uplift, you somehow have to factor that in. And some of the recommendations that are made by analysts, if it was the CEO making those recommendations, we'd go to jail. You know, it's somewhere there needs to be accountability for advising shareholders or future investors either not to buy in or to sell out or do whatever the advice is. And when it turns out to be the wrong advice, there needs to be consequences, just like there is for CEOs. But Bronwyn, I try and stay above it. You know, I want to say, until you run a company, you actually don't know how difficult it is. You got to differentiate yourself. You have to deliver. You know, investors can, their money is mobile. They can go anywhere. We pride ourselves on constantly looking back to when we started, and our total shareholder returns, you know, based on capital growth, based on dividend payments, and we stand out above most companies. It's only the gold companies today that have been you know, fortunate to, let's say, have the capital growth they've had. But we still rank right up there, number one, two, or three over 10 years in terms of the value we've delivered, eh?
Now, the other element that we need to talk about is the bullying that you experienced from labor unions. And then I want to talk about government and a similar level of potential bullying. Let's start with the labor unions and the toll that it's taken on you, although you have prevailed, right?
Yes. Look, it's not easy to be subject to their criticism, which is rhetoric. They don't have disclosure requirements like we do as listed companies. They can sprout just about anything, and as I say, most of it is rhetoric and rubbish, which is unfortunate. But again, we pride ourselves in having stuck to the facts, maintained what I consider top-class disclosure, not getting emotionally involved, fully understanding that we had no, agenda that was to the detriment of any of our stakeholders. But we are responsible for management of the company. We are responsible to our shareholders, our communities, our employees, and of course, we're responsible to the unions, and we take that very seriously. And if anything, I would describe management's role in today's environment of, let's call it, stakeholder capitalism as one of trying to find that balance. And as you know, we have a tree that we use, which is a very important symbol to us. And it's a way of saying to a union, your demands are this. So which one of these stakeholders do you want us to take it from and why? Because you're being unreasonable. And you take that, you depersonalize the issue, and then the answer is no. And to say no, you've got to be strong. You've got to be firm. You've got to know roughly what your counterparty is going to do. And we did. We called it correctly when we were trying to finalize the Lonmin transaction and AMCU embarked on strikes in our gold business because their view was that was where they would hurt us. They forgot that we had an operation in the U.S. that was very profitable. And in fact, it carried us through that period. And we knew we could withstand a long strike, not that that was in the interests of our company or our employees. And we prevailed. We prevailed and we leveled that playing field. We took back our right to manage these assets, which was the appointment that we have as managers. And it wasn't with a view to union bashing. In fact, what was not well known is we had very good relationships at the operations. The rhetoric comes from the national bodies who don't always enjoy the full support of their members. And as long as we have, let me call it that, social license to operate, we will continue to do those difficult things because many other companies don't. They pay for peace. But meanwhile, you affect the sustainability of the business in the long run. So that was a difficult era. But you can see, Bronwyn, after that, relationships have normalized. Our business runs well. We get good, probably the best wage agreements in the industry. And of course, it's not our, we would like to avoid confrontation, but we won't tolerate one stakeholder abusing another. The same with government. You know, when government said, you've got to re-empower your business and, we're going to increase it to 30%, the answer was no. Our shareholders, if we agree to it, rightly so, should fire us. And therefore, The answer is no, because we will protect shareholder interests. They invested on the basis of the rules that were in place at the time. Now, we're not anti-transformational, but you are not going to abuse our shareholders. And we know we've got the backing of our shareholders. And if necessary, and it was necessary, we'll take you to court. And of course, we are fortunate we still have good judicial and legal systems that we can fall back on. And we prevailed in those circumstances as well.
You speak of the tree. It's the Mdoni tree. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
You are. Yes.
Why specifically is this such a critical analogy? You talk about balancing stakeholder elements. Can you play that back for me a little further?
Yes. So first of all, trees are important symbols to mankind. You know, trees live in communities. Trees talk to each other, and trees prosper in areas where the ground is fertile. Now, trees are symbols, and funny enough, when we listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the CEO there got up and spoke about their fir tree, and I was able to stand up after him and say, well, let me tell you about our Mdoni tree. So let me tell you about it. So, you know, the roots of the tree are the values of an organization. And of course, a tree needs to be anchored in a strong way, and it's through your roots. So it's important for an organization to have strong values. The trunk of the tree is the strength of the tree, and that's our people. If you look at our tree, you'll see signs of people as holding up the canopy of the tree, and the trunk gives it strength and direction, as I've said. Now, for a tree to grow and prosper, the organization needs to be profitable. So in our tree, you'll see people holding up safe, cost, volume, and grade, or quality. And those are the elements of being profitable as a mining business. And of course, if you get that right, then your tree develops a canopy. And in the canopy, we list all our stakeholders and the environment. So our stakeholders listed in our tree, if you go to our website, is communities, is government, is the unions, is management, is suppliers, shareholders. And then, of course, a very important part is the environment, which is not a stakeholder, but the environment comes into the canopy of the tree. Now, if the tree is really healthy, it delivers fruit. And the fruit of the tree is the superior value. We call it superior value, which is our vision of creating superior value for all stakeholders. And we can tell you that for shareholders, we know it's total returns. You know, for government, you know, it's social upliftment, the same for communities. And so you can define what superior value is for every one of those stakeholders. And that tree defines our ethos, and it incorporates what we call stakeholder capitalism. Because when you talk to a government, especially a government like ours that has an ideology that's steeped in communism and socialism, they think of capitalism like it was in the 60s and 70s, where it was only about shareholders. And that all changed in sort of the late 2018-19, when the American business roundtable said that shareholder primacy is something of the past. Businesses have to create value for all stakeholders, not just shareholders. And our tree was developed in 2013, so it was ahead of its time, and we've received lots of accolades for that thinking. But that puts the tree in perspective and creates that concept of stakeholder capitalism. So we can, so when you talk to a government who says we're going to increase your requirements for empowerment, you can say, well, who are you going to take it from in the street? Who are you negatively affecting? And you're actually now starting to undermine this tree. This tree is not going to grow anymore. And so it becomes a very useful symbol and concept, which was home developed. And if ever I said what was the legacy I'd want to leave behind at Sibanye, it's our tree.
I think beautiful to hear that unpacked, and a number of branding experts must be listening intently to this conversation now, thinking that that is such a great analogy in terms of a business and keeping the balance and the growth trajectory in the right direction. Let's look at South Africa today. And I know when we last spoke at your farewell, you mentioned that you keep an eye on news flow across the South African spectrum. How are you feeling about the general environment that we are operating in today? And here, I suppose, Neil, I'm going to put it clearly back in government's sphere to say, do you believe that things are getting worse? Are we seeing an enabling environment being created? Does the GNU give you hope? Let me stop there and put the ball back to you.
Listen, I am, for the first time, very worried about South Africa. Look, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think the GNU is a very important part of what I'm going to say. And the GNU, in my mind, creates light at the end of the tunnel. But I don't want anyone listening to this thinking that I'm saying it's all good and rosy. It's not. There's a huge amount of work to do. But the fact that we now seem to have more of a balance in government, but it's not a constructive balance. Don't get me wrong. But at least we have political parties, and in particular the DA, digging in its heels and saying no. Now I know the president feels that is negative. It's not negative. That is exactly how a coalition works. They cannot always agree, especially when there are proposals to do the wrong things. And you know, all credit to those political parties that see their role as doing the right things. And you know, that's how we run companies. The most difficult decisions are the ones that are normally about doing the right things, and they're not popular decisions. And that's where government, in my view, thinks that friendly relationships are good relationships. They're not. Credible relationships are one where you respect and you involve your counterparties in the right way. So I think my view is the ANC is in desperate trouble. There's a lack of delivery. And listen, it's very bad to generalize, and I will come back to that shortly. But you know, there's at local government level, there's, you know, and we can talk about Johannesburg, there's a complete mess, to be honest. People are running these municipalities that are not competent. How they get there, you know, defies logic. And it takes good people and hard work to run these type of organizations and deliver to the people that you represent as a civil servant. What I want to say is that, you know, we engage with government at the highest levels and at levels below, let's call it political leadership. And I liken it to a company. You know, we've bought companies that have failed, and quite honestly, you know, we are talking about a failure of state here. And those companies are comprised of good people but bad leadership. So when we talk of government, there are lots of good people within government working hard, just as despondent about crime and corruption as you and I are. And therefore, we got to be careful when we generalize. We got to blame leadership. This is not, you know, bad companies, you change leadership and you put in good leadership and the same company then works well. So I think we desperately need changes in leadership, and it doesn't mean everybody in leadership is poor or bad or corrupt. I'm not saying that at all, but clearly the if you look at the scoreboard, there's no growth. Crime and corruption is a pandemic, all of that is going to require leadership to change it, and civil society, I think, sees right through the promises, the lack of change, and they will vote in the right way in my view at these you know, the next government local elections, and I think it'll result in a change in leadership, which is desperately necessary. Now, you know, if I simplify the problem and the sort of reforms that are required, if inequality and poverty are our biggest issues in South Africa, which they are, and that features in unemployment, then clearly what we need to do is create more jobs. You can't cut up the pie any smaller. To create jobs means we need economic growth. For economic growth, we need an investor-friendly climate. And right now, our policies, let's call it our sort of those commercial policies that influence business, are bad policies. Anything that discriminates against a specific class of person in the modern world is a no-no. So we've got a lot of race-based legislation. It's a no-no. It's not conducive to investment. That, again, I want to say, as per our tree and some of our earlier discussions, does not mean we're anti-transformative. In fact, to the contrary, I don't think there's a single business leader that I know that doesn't believe in transformation and the importance of it. But you don't have to write it into legislation. You don't have to discriminate against any particular group or gender and so on. So we have very poor legislation that is outdated, needs to be reformed, that'll be the first step in getting an investor-friendly environment. But then on the flip side of that, when you look at our foreign policy, and remember that the capital markets that business requires are the Western capital markets, specifically the U.S. And what do? We continue to poke the U.S. in the eye. We continue to think that China and Russia are going to step up, God forbid, Iran. So our foreign policy is incongruent with a requirement for an investor-friendly environment and for businesses to flourish. So unless there are real reforms, you know, to legislation that is race-based or expropriation without compensation, you can list all of them. And unless we change the tone on our foreign policy, we don't have to bow to the United States. We don't have to bow to any particular country. But we got to stop being stupid with our foreign policy. We will not get growth unless we have these reforms. We need a change in guard, we need the GNU to continue so that it balances out the power. We need government to tighten its belt. We need more money spent on education. We need more money spent on crime and corruption. You can't raise taxes. Government's got to cut back on its spending like we would as a business. And Bronwyn, you know, I sit here and I'm very critical, but I'm also part of working with government. And I can assure you, I don't have different messages when I talk to, you know, to a forum like this, or I talk to government. It's the same message. They don't always like what I say, but I speak from the heart.
In terms of leadership, perhaps I can put this to you. If you look at South Africa and we use the analogy of a company, at the helm is our CEO, Cyril. Should he be abdicating his position?
Well, certainly he's either got to demonstrate that he will turn things around, that he will deal with crime and corruption decisively. He's got to be able to demonstrate that he'll put people in places that can run municipalities or state-owned enterprises, whatever it is. He's got to be able to demonstrate that. Otherwise, I do believe that civil society will vote with their, will vote, you know, I would like to say with their feet. That's like a shareholder, but they will vote. And unfortunately, I think that's clear what it probably means. So the time is running out, and I think he is going to be tested. He is absolutely going to be tested. And I think his recent remarks about, you know, go and learn from where it's working. As much as he's being criticized, I must tell you, that's a very mature sign. That's a sign that there are discussions. If he's willing to say that publicly, internally, there could well be discussions taking place that are going to, you know, create that change. I have no specific leaning to any political party. I just want our country to and government to act in the national interest. I really don't mind who's president, as long as they are not corrupt, they are strong leaders, and they deliver.
What do you make of the recent news around Helen Ziller being put forward as the DA's mayoral candidate for Johannesburg?
Listen, I think that's fantastic, and not because Helen is DA, but she's a lady that'll deliver. And if there's anyone that can turn Johannesburg around, it's Helen. All credit to her. You know, that takes a lot of guts and backbone. And she will have to have a thick skin, but I would expect you'll get a lot of support. I just hope that it's turnaroundable. I mean, there are some jobs I've taken on that have fortunately not been visible in the public space, you know, lower level roles in business where it was impossible to be successful. This is a very visible role, and I really hope she can be successful. All credit to her.
I've got a final question. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but I'd love to get your steer on the mining sector, specifically in South Africa, given obviously the underpin to Sibanye-Stillwater, which has been to diversify, especially from a geographic perspective. Your thoughts on mining as an industry in South Africa?
You know, South Africa has such a great legacy from a mining perspective. We have infrastructure, we have financial markets, we have a whole financial services sector. We have, you know, technology, we have technical support. Yet, we continue to go backwards in terms of something like the Fraser Institute, ratings. And again, it's a bit like my previous comments. We have to understand why. And it's primarily because of legislation. It's primarily because of a lack of delivery in the mining sector, cadastral systems, the onerous BEE requirements. Our minister continues to double down on doing the wrong things, whereas he's got such a good guide in terms of the Fraser Institute as to what he needs to change to start moving it in the other direction. We're well endowed. We have an abundance of labor, and not only is it an abundance of labor, it's abundance of skilled labor in the sector. So it's very sad to me that nobody wants to come and mine here or invest here, but it goes to those core problems. Get the legislation investor-friendly and get our foreign policy so that it's balanced and it recognizes the role the Western markets will play, and you will then get an investment in the mining sector, and the mining sector could easily be 10 to 15, maybe even 20% of GDP, but it requires a reform, and it's an ideological reform, which it just seems like the ANC is incapable of doing.
Neil, thank you so much for your time. It's been a privilege to sit down with you. Neil Froneman is the CEO of Sibanye-Stillwater.